Now, the Dublin Rape Crisis Centre's annual report for 2020, throughout much of which we were in some form of lockdown, showed it received 13,000 contacts to its national helpline in 2020 and delivered over 6,000 one-on-one counselling and therapy sessions. To talk us through the report and its implications, I'm joined on the line now by Chief Executive of the DRCC, Nolene Blackwell. Nolene, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thank you, Ciara. Thank you for inviting me.
And we're delighted to do so. One key thing that really jumps out at me from this report is that we often erroneously assume that acts of sexual violence occur, let's say, in settings where there may be alcohol, you're out at a nightclub, you're at a party, etc., etc. This clearly shows, given that there were no such things available at that time, that sexual violence happens really mostly in domestic settings.
Yeah, or at least in familiar settings in some way. That's exactly right. I mean, it's just one of those things that people have in the back of their minds that, you know, it's drink, it's clubbing, it's Saturday nights. This is what causes rape and sexual assault. And that it's always by kind of, you know, recent acquaintances or people who are on virtually strangers and the spiked drinks. In fact, that is and always have been the minority of cases of rape and sexual abuse that we come across. Like every single year, this year, 2020 being no different to most, 20% of those who were coming seeking therapy from us for rape and other sexual abuse were identifying their partner or their ex-partner as the source of the abuse. Every year, up to 50%, in or about 50%, of those who as adults come to us having been abused as children, they've been abused within the family. So again, it is, and again, like Minister Josepha Madigan said when she was launching the report this morning, home not being the safe place, home being the place of danger for people. And that was, I think in some ways, while we knew that was likely to be a problem and we were very concerned about that from the get-go, it was some recognition of that by the state, by TUSLA making our services and domestic violence services priorities, by the Gardaí saying the restrictions on where you can go do not apply if you're fleeing violence. By the Department of Justice setting out its campaign, confirming the services were still going. That didn't solve anything, Ciara, but at least it recognised that we are now getting to a stage where it is not cosy in every household. It is not safe in every household. And we continued to hear of people who have recently been sexually abused, including raped, in situations by people known to them in close situations, as it were, rather than those random Saturday night events. And I think maybe we'll learn that. Again, one of the things I'm kind of conscious of is if we don't learn lessons from the pandemic, we will have wasted opportunities as well. And maybe that's one of the things that's becoming more obvious to all of us in society, how actually the norm is the familiar. And the norm for sexual abuse happens in familiar situations.
And the level of service, Nolene, that you and colleagues in DRCC were able to continue to provide, despite having to pivot, along with many other support organisations, incredibly quickly, is extraordinary. 6,000 one-on-one counselling and therapy sessions delivered to clients, perhaps showing the profound intensity of ongoing trauma for many people.
Yeah. Yeah, and in fact, it shows flexibility both on the part of our therapists and on the part of our clients, neither of whom would have been familiar at all with doing therapy sessions by phone or by video. You know, simply this wasn't in the grand scheme of things. And everybody happened to make it work. But it's interesting. In fact, the number of clients we saw was less than we think we would have seen if there had been no pandemic, because clients needed more help sometimes. You know, they really did. I think on top of all of the trauma, all of the anxiety that comes with the injury that is sexual violence. There was also that general trauma that we all suffered as a nation. And indeed, one of the best studies on this was done by one of our board members now, but Professor Philip Highland in Maynooth did a piece of work just identifying the level of trauma that the general population suffered. And if you add that on top of the pain that people with experience of sexual violence were already suffering, that meant that they had an awful lot to cope with. So, in fact, they needed extra help sometimes, or as things pivoted, an hour session on the phone mightn't have worked. Our therapist then worked with that and maybe gave them 2 half-hour sessions, broke up the day, which meant they had more appointments over a longer time. But we were so grateful, Ciara, to be able to do it. Mm. I mean, the one thing that I suppose saved us was we did keep all of our services going. We actually expanded our services during the year and we innovated a bit. But that was a great, we were very grateful for everyone who made it possible, but it was also a great satisfaction to us that in a time of such general anxiety and hurt, where the people who needed our support were looking for it, we were able to keep the services going. It's kind of a privilege in some ways to be able to do something, and we do feel that we were able to, and I mean, we're not holding ourselves out as martyrs or anything, but it was great to be part of a solution, which we think we were.
Another key part of that solution, and I know it's something that DRCC has been working extensively on over a number of years, is the consent piece, bringing that message out into wider society and in ensuring or enabling individuals to have a true and profound understanding of what consent is. And I think there was a report released very recently showing a significant proportion of teenage boys have really no concept of consent at all, which is why ongoing education and messaging for all age groups, all demographics, is really important. And to that end, you've released a new animated video as part of the launch today of your annual report, setting out how to make consent a normal part of sexual encounters. We've come some way in this, Nolene, an awful long way to go.
That's right. But at least the steps are being taken. The weekend before everything shut down in Ireland, so the weekend of the 8th of March, which was also the weekend of International Women's Day and the rest of it, we ran a session with 21 influential TikTokers. These were young people who were doing TikTok. They were all over 18 at the time, but they were still young. And they had these massive fan bases. And they came and they worked with us for a day on the meaning of consent. And then they went off and organized their own TikTok videos and the rest of it. Brilliant stuff going out. But it was, even at that, we were absolutely clear, and they were clear, that they had never had the opportunity before to really sit down, even as young people, and talk through what consent meant in different cases, how that meant respecting other people, what that looked like in the context of young people. So building on that then, our brilliant Youth Advisory Council, which is run out of our education and training department, they developed their own interest in working on a consent video during the pandemic. And it was just lovely that Grainne Henry, who's part of that group, introduced that today and released it. Grainne is one of our great volunteers, works with us in a number of capacities. And it just, it reminded us that the way I would talk about consent is different to the way somebody of a different generation would talk about it, is different to the way that a man might talk about it, and that we actually really need to have not a conversation, but lots of conversations right across different genders, demographics, parts of the country, to try and build up a mindset or a common understanding of the importance of consent. Because when it comes down to it, Ciara, we're very often, as a rape crisis centre, we're making the point that rape is sexual intercourse without consent. And so it kind of tends to get tied into criminal behaviour, and we fail to recognise that it's actually part of totally respecting other people in one of the best ways you can, in the area of intimate relationships, in the area of sexual activity. So we really are going to put, we're going to put time and thought and money, if we can get it, into building a really sustained campaign over the next few years, a project to just build out the conversations we can have in this country about consent, so that it is normal to talk about it, and so that it's normal to believe in consensual sexual activity, and that we all have the language and the thinking about what that means, and that we all kind of are aware of the ways in which we've grown up thinking that, basically thinking that women and children were owned by somebody else, their father or their husband or their son, depending, and that gave people entitlement. Also recognizing where same-sex relationships have changed the narrative in relation to that, what do we do about that, and to make sure that as we address those things, that we recognise that everybody of every gender understands respect. I think, again, the minister said respect, equality and kindness. Imagine if we could bring that into the area of sexual activity. We would actually really, I'm not sure we'd take away the need ever for rape crisis centres, but we could reduce the need for it, reduce the hurt that sexual violence causes, and actually build up a healthier society which is more equal.
Well, Nolene Blackwell, Chief Executive of the Dublin Rape Crisis Centre, thank you indeed for joining us. And I'm just going to give you out now the Dublin Rape Crisis Centre's national 24-hour helpline, should you need it. It's 1800 77 88 88. That's 1800 77 88 88. Now, the Irish Society of Chartered Physiotherapists is launching Ireland's first long COVID hub. And to discuss this, joined on the line by ISCP Professional Advisor Esther Mary. Esther, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thank you very much.
Esther Mary Darcy, can you tell us the genesis of the establishment of this hub?
We have several physiotherapists who are working with patients with long COVID. And there was a concern that there wasn't a place, a go-to place for people who were wondering if they did have long COVID, or people who had long COVID, as to where they could get all the information together in one place. And so my respiratory colleagues in physiotherapy brought together these documents that are obviously world documents, and the evidence that we have to date. There isn't a huge amount of evidence to guide best practice for people who have long COVID. But I suppose the important message that we also wanted to get out there is that this is manageable, that people who have it, will need help. They don't need to be scared. There is information available, and there's also treatment available. We're just encouraging people to use it, and also encouraging people to come forward, and indeed for the HSE to kind of expedite their plan to establish long COVID clinics around the country. There are some already set up, but more are needed.
I'm speaking entirely anecdotally, that it seems a proportion of people who are living with long COVID feel that there is nowhere to turn. And I would hazard a guess, just given my own interactions with people in my day-to-day life, that there are people that are living with long COVID, but the symptoms are so low level, their experience is so low level, that they don't necessarily perceive that this is long COVID.
Yeah, indeed, that can be the case. And I mean, I think the definition of long COVID is for any person whose symptoms that they've had during COVID, any of the symptoms at all, and even last for longer than 12 weeks. And that can be any range of symptoms. And certainly what we are seeing most would be people with experiencing fatigue and experiencing shortness of breath, and people who perhaps even physical activity is causing sort of after the exertion of the physical activity, and that may not be much physical activity, they are sort of feeling really fatigued, and you know, their oxygen levels may drop. So, you know, it can be, and I think sometimes we don't, you know, we don't want to make a fuss. We wonder what's going on. You know, we've been unwell. We don't want to be unwell anymore. But really, I suppose our message is that this is manageable, and people can do it with self-management. But we would encourage them to come forward for help to start that management process, so that they can work on it on their own. And it's really about, I suppose, pacing themselves, planning their activity, and prioritising what they need to do. But
now, Esther Mary, this hub has been sent up for people suffering with acute and ongoing symptoms of COVID, as well as their families, carers and the general public. How can people access this resource?
Well, that's through simply askthephysio.ie /long COVID. But even just to go into the website, askthephysio.ie, they'll see the long COVID section there, and it's accessible to all of the public.
And can you give me a flavour of the broad church of information and resources that people will find there?
Okay. Well, the information will range from, for instance, the the guidelines produced by our World Professional Organisation. That's the organisation of 125 countries around the world and 660,000 physiotherapists. So they brought together a group of physiotherapy experts in respiratory and in other areas, obviously neurology, because there are other symptoms, cardiac symptoms, etc., to put together this document. So that's a helpful document. It's very clear in terms of the management of it. There are, say, the more scientific NICE, what are called the NICE guidelines and things. And then there's a booklet that we produced ourselves, which is for people with symptoms and also for families and carers, because sometimes it can be worrying for family members if they're watching someone and they're not quite sure what's going on. So it's, you know, we would encourage people who have any concerns to access it as well. And it's, you know, to pick up those practical tips in managing it. But I say also to come forward, even for, you know, to see a physiotherapist where there is a COVID clinic, just in terms of perhaps helping with breathing, something as simple as the breathing exercises, and sometimes a session on how to deal with your breathing, how to deal with it, you know, after exercise if it's bothering you. Things as simple as that can be of great benefit.
Well, Esther Mary Darcy, Professional Advisor at the Irish Society of Chartered Physiotherapists, thank you indeed for joining us. And that website, again, is askthephysio.ie. Just over 3,500 men, women and children were supported by DePaul last year. It's just released its annual report, and I'm joined on the line by Chief Executive David Carroll to discuss it. David, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thank you, Ciara. Good to be here.
But we're delighted to have you. 3,500 men, women and children, 410 families, 772 children facing homelessness were assisted by DePaul. Those numbers are staggering.
Well, it's been such a year, Ciara, that we've all been through. But you can imagine, I think, what it's like to have been in homelessness in the past 18, 20 months, where there's been kind of huge difficulties for people in temporary accommodation to be able to get through what we've all seen has been a huge, difficult time in all of our lives. But I think it's a testament to ourselves within DePaul that we were able to kind of offer so much support to such a group of vulnerable people.
And it was an incredibly large group of vulnerable people, and you know, 8 babies born in DePaul services last year. A happy time, always the welcoming of babies, but into such circumstances must have caused distress to their parents.
Well, I mean, anybody who's in temporary accommodation, it's a hugely kind of difficult experience. But I would want to say that anybody who we would run a number of kind of temporary accommodation or hostels for families, that the best possible support are given to those families and those new parents in order to be able to kind of get through the, you know, to be able to negotiate the birth of a new child, and they're given comprehensive kind of support in order to be able to work on what any new parent works on: nutrition, emotional support, all of those, settling the baby in, the sleep routines. But ultimately, we're here to move people on out of homelessness. And we've worked with those families very, very quickly to be able to find long-term accommodation for people.
And you had a massive increase, David, in the number of people for whom you were able to do that last year on 2019. 554 people across all of your services moved on to suitable homes. That's an enormous, enormous increase.
You would think, Ciara, that in the year that was in it, that where we were all being hit with lockdown and COVID, that it would have been really, really difficult to do that. But we found that there was a high availability of accommodation within the private rented sector, and we were able to use housing assistance payment in order to be able to support those families. We're geared up, and we do gear ourselves up as an organisation to make sure that the first question we ask anybody coming into our services is, what's your next step? If you're in temporary accommodation, how are you going to get your long-term solution? And this year, we've managed to increase that, which is fantastic. And you know what? The willingness and the absolute desire for any of the families or single people in temporary accommodation has been absolutely to the fore in finding their own homes. People were eager and hungry to get out of temporary accommodation, where there was obviously restrictions due to lockdown and COVID, and so therefore we were delighted absolutely that we were able to get that increase this year in particular.
You also took another really big step towards permanent stable housing provision for those people, David, that use your service, and that was launching your approved housing body. No mean feat in the middle of a pandemic, but in particular securing 11 properties in all, just in your first year as a housing body.
We know that one of the main solutions to homelessness is providing housing. And, you know, our organisation has actually focused on people with complex and vulnerable needs. And we were really happy last year to be able to kind of set the approved housing body up. That's hugely important in the context of the government's plan, Housing for All, that was published last week, where one of the main kind of achievements or objectives will be how approved housing bodies work with government to be able to obtain housing to get people out of temporary accommodation, or indeed prevent going into temporary accommodation in the first place. You know, the solution to this housing crisis is housing. To be able to set up the approved housing body, particularly focusing on people who some people have given up on, that they can never be housed, is, I think, a huge achievement both for us but also the people who've actually managed to move into those tenancies.
Well, David Carroll, Chief Executive of DePaul, thank you indeed for joining with us and sharing with us the details of your annual report. Do remember comments, requests or dedications by text or WhatsApp to 0833 97 97 97. Now, this has been a debate since the dawn of eggs and boiling, but a statistician has developed a foolproof formula to boil the perfect egg. Dr. James Hind of Nottingham University surveyed 1,500 people to find out their method for making dippy eggs, soft boiled eggs, googie eggs, whatever you want to call them, and soldiers. I love soft boiled eggs. The expert found eggs should be boiled for 4 minutes, 25 seconds precisely, then plunged into cold water for 57 seconds to stop the cooking process. I mean, would you be bothered? He said the eggs were then best to be enjoyed with a slice of white bread that was precisely 2.1 centimetres. I say make them whatever way works for you, just as long as they're delicious and you've plenty of soldiers. And another thing that has gone is apparently elevenses. They're no longer our favourite time to snack. A new survey of 2,000 adults found 11 a.m. has been replaced with mid-afternoon as people's favourite time to grab a biscuit or a banana. I don't need a set time to do that, to be honest. The poll identified 3:48 precisely as the most popular time to reach for a snack, with 43% of people enjoying savoury and 42% opting for a sweeter option. 0833 97 97 97 for your comments, your requests and your dedications. The Irish Nurses and Midwives organisation is holding an emergency meeting of nurse managers at Nice General today after receiving warnings from staff about what it describes as unsafe clinical environments and staffing levels at the Kildare facility. To discuss this, I'm joined on the line by INMO Industrial Relations Officer Joe Hoolan. Joe, you're very welcome to the programme.
Good afternoon, Ciara.
This certainly seems on the face of it to be a situation of concern, around 50 nursing posts unavailable to cover frontline services at Nice General Hospital. What does that mean in layperson's terms?
Well, in layperson's terms, it means that there are not enough nurses to cover frontline rosters. So if you're a patient going into Nice Hospital today, you will not see enough nursing staff on all ward areas and intensive care areas and in emergency department and throughout the hospital itself. You'll see nurses running because that's all they can do to try and deliver some sort of a service, but you won't have time to stop and speak to a nurse, such as the level of vacancies there. We had a meeting with our nurse managers a couple of weeks ago who brought this to our attention, and they described to us perilous conditions at times, very unsafe clinical environments. And we wrote to management seeking an urgent meeting in regarding same. So we met with management. And to say we were disappointed was an understatement. There is no dispute that there are up to 50 nursing vacancies in the hospital. There is no dispute that frontline rosters are struggling. Where there was no agreement was in relation to consolidating those rosters, closing non-essential services, redeploying staff into frontline rosters for a period of time until NACE can get recruitment into the front door. Unfortunately, management adopted the view that they will pay enhanced overtime rates for any staff member who wants to work extra. And although that's welcomed, it's not going to attract the numbers of staff required in order to address the 50 vacancies.
It also relies on existing staff to want to work overtime or to be
in a
position to work overtime or to have the physical energy to work overtime.
That's right. And some staff will do that because they feel such a loyalty to their colleagues and they want to have them working short, or they feel such a loyalty to their patients as well and they don't want to see their patients suffer. But there comes a stage where they just reach further exhaustion, and we're talking about an already exhausted workforce. So our difficulty is that there seems to be a head-in-the-sand approach from senior management that if we wait long enough, this will be all right on the night. It won't. The problem will be that adverse clinical events will occur, and that's what's driving our members to seek management to take a more proactive approach. We have written to management saying if such a scenario arose, then you cannot realistically expect a nurse or a midwife to be held responsible for that. You have a responsibility to safely staff your hospital, and if you don't have the numbers required, then you have a responsibility to temporarily close services in order to consolidate the frontline rosters and the emergency department. Those services cannot close.
Is Nice General allowed by the HSE or the Dublin Midlands Hospital Group to close services in the current context, though?
That's a very good question. And when we discussed this with the Dublin Midlands Hospital Group, they will state to us that whatever measures Nice propose, they will support. So we're not aware that Nice have actually asked the Dublin Midlands Hospital Group to close services yet. If you recall, back in November, Nice was essentially on the edge of the cliff again from a staffing perspective because of COVID and COVID leave. At that stage, they had no choice but to close theatres, endoscopies, OPDs, day wards, etc., realign their services, redeploy staff for a short period of time. We're of the view that this is now required again, such as the levels of roster deficits that exist throughout the hospital.
And Joe, did those measures deployed last November work? Did they have the desired effect?
They did, and they did stabilise the frontline rosters, and the staff on the wards themselves were very appreciative that their colleagues came out of the areas that they normally work in and worked alongside them for a number of weeks. And what it did was it bought the hospital some time in order to get staff back into the service. Not all the vacancies in NACE are due to actual vacancies that need to be recruited in. They're a combination of sick leave, maternity leave, COVID leave. And gradually people do start to come back, and also there will be some recruitment. But until that happens, we're saying you need to pause, everyone needs to take a breath, you need to consolidate your services and you need to make them safe. We shouldn't be the organisation having to tell you to do that. It should be an automatic reaction of management anyway. Disappointingly, that's not the response we received at our last meeting. So we're meeting with our members this afternoon to decide what the next steps we would take.
Joe, will you come back to us on that?
No problem. Yeah, we're happy to chat to you whenever you want to talk.
Great stuff. That's Joe Hoolan, Industrial Relations Officer at the INMO, just ahead of this afternoon's meeting with NACE General. And Joe will, of course, be a guest on tomorrow morning's edition of Kildare Today with Clem Ryan. Just got a text into us here. It seems as this school transport issue is rumbling on for an awful lot of families throughout County Kildare. Radek Nowak has texted in on 0833 97 97 97 saying, we live in Castle Dermot. This time next year, our boy is going to secondary school in Carlow. We're heartbroken to find out that there's no school transport for secondary school students from Castle Dermot. If I recall rightly, Kildare Today spoke to Rhianna very recently, maybe late last week. She's also a Castle Dermot resident. Her son is attending school in Carlow and she couldn't find a place on a school bus for him. The nearest, it wasn't that there wasn't a place on the bus, it's that the bus route couldn't be rejigged or realigned. Thank you, Kira. Rejigged or realigned in order to find a pickup point closer to the family home than 11 kilometres, which is very close to the school itself. But thank you indeed, Radek, for getting in touch. Now, Angelina Jolie was recently quoted as saying, it took a lot for me to separate from the father of my children. And I know most people might be rolling their eyes and saying, well, she's loaded. Well, that only greases the wheels of transition so much. She still had six children to help get used to a new normal and find her own place in the world. To discuss divorce, the effects of parents staying together for the sake of the kids, I'm joined on the line by Dr. Vincent McDarby. He's President-elect of the Psychological Society of Ireland. Vincent, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thank you very much, Clara.
I think generations of families, particularly in Ireland before the advent of divorce and to a greater or lesser degree thereafter, have very much stayed together for the sake of the kids, either by choice or by lack of other option. And I imagine the cases in which the kids actually benefit from that are few and far between.
It depends on the situation, you know, particularly, I mean, if the children are going to be exposed to a lot of conflict, well, then it is associated with poor outcomes in terms of their psychological well-being. And even if it's not conflict, if they're exposed to a lot of silent treatment or known as mentioned, the elephant in the room, it's equally detrimental, particularly in that sort of situation. You can end up with children being what we call triangulated. So they're being used as a conduit to communicate information from one parent to the other. So, you know, dad is saying, you know, tell your mum that I'm going to take you swimming tomorrow, or whatever it is. It just draws the children into the centre of the conflict.
And I imagine if you asked either of those parents in that swimming triangle conversation, if they ever imagined if they would end up in such a farcical situation, they would have said no. And they probably are scratching their heads going, I have no idea how we got here.
Yeah, and you know, these situations end up happening. Do you know what I mean? You know, the reality is relationships break down, marriages break down. That's part of life, you know, and due to often circumstances outside of parents' control, you know, be it financial reasons or whatever, they're not able to actually separate. They have to continue living in the same house. It's not ideal, but I mean, there's things you can do to make it easier for the children, you know, and like I said, particularly not exposing them to conflict, not triangulate them, and explain to them, you know, they pick up the tension, they know something, they'll explain to them at a level they can understand what's happening, and give them, you know, whatever degree of, I suppose, predictability you can in terms of, this is what we hope is going to be happening over the next few months or years or whatever it is.
Because even I would imagine, Vincent, in a household where there isn't any outward conflict, when there isn't that triangulation, even if you're trying to be amicable but keep it from the children, inevitably one person will feel contempt or disdain, another will feel hurt, maybe both people will feel both at various different times. And, you know, children are not immune to being able to pick up on their parents' emotions. So the conversation itself is important.
Yeah, I mean, children will pick up when there's, you know, when there's changes there. The nature of when relationships break down, there's going to be periods where one parent feels particularly aggrieved, maybe in relation to the other parent, or both of them, which is going to affect how they interact. It's going to affect how they communicate. And the reality is, children do pick it up. You know, much and all as we try and hide it, they generally do. They notice when something's up. They notice when communication isn't the way it normally is. So it is good to give them some degree of kind of heads up of what's happening. And again, it depends on, you know, the age of the child, their developmental level.
And as you say, Vincent, that the age of that child is key, because it will dictate their emotional and intellectual ability to understand, but also the language that they have available to them to express how they feel.
Yeah, I mean, particularly when you look at very younger children, they can have, you know, not just difficulty expressing emotions, but they have difficulty labeling emotions, you know, and very often what they feel as maybe anxiety or fear, and that they feel, you know, they express it as physical pain. You know, I've got pains in my tummies and that, you know, so they can have difficulty labeling and understanding their emotions. That's why it's good to actually be able to sit down and, you know, explain the separation of the divorce in a language they can understand and try and normalize their feelings, you know, because, you know, no matter how smooth the separation, the divorce is, there's always going to be a temporary sense of kind of loss and grief among children. And that's completely normal. But the reality is that most children, they're resilient, and providing parents are able to kind of navigate the separation, the divorce well, they don't generally exhibit, you know, kind of any long-term psychological issues if it's handled correctly.
And that's another thing. There is this, I suppose we've gotten it from generations and generations of Hollywood films like Kramer and Kramer, and where there's absolutely horrific divorces which have long-lasting consequences for the rest of everybody's lives. There seems to be, to a degree, a stereotype that because your parents either have or are going through a divorce, you will be irrevocably damaged. But that's not an inevitability.
No, not at all. Absolutely not. And the research doesn't show that. I mean, what happens is, you know, at the point of separation and divorce, there's a period of upset, you know, and it's adjustment. So what happens is, you know, parents separate, they end up, you know, the children live in two different houses, but children are resilient and they get used to a new normal pretty quickly, particularly younger children. Young children, you know, can adjust pretty quickly, providing we give them structure and routine, we don't expose them to any conflict. And, you know, they understand that, okay, although, you know, mammy and daddy may not love each other in the same way, they still love them. I mean, most children are very strongly attached to both parents. Mm. And if one parent starts to openly reject the other parent, they're in essence rejecting a part of that child. And that child has huge difficulty resolving that. You know, I'm attached to this parent, but yet my other parent is rejecting of them. And that's where you see the issues from a psychological point of view.
Well, Dr. Vincent McDarby, President-elect of the Psychological Society of Ireland, thank you indeed for joining us there. And if you want to read that full piece on Angelina Jolie, you can find it in the Irish Times by Simon Hattonstone.